back to the show. Yes, this is part two, as promised, of last week's episode, where we talked to Australian food industry analyst, consultant and advisor Steve Spencer, who is a director at Fresh Agenda, Kite's managing partner John Allen, and as always, everyone's favourite dairy market analyst, Chris Walkland.
Yes, listeners, we're really giving you value for money this week. It's part one, which I'm sure you've all listened to, we heard from Steve about how the COVID situation has been in Australia and its impact on dairy and food purchasing, as well as on prices, and also heard about retailer price pressure and how that's affecting farmers in Australia and the UK. But today's episode focuses on milk contracts.
So without further ado, here's part two of this week's podcast.
Let's put this all of this in the context of the British consultation, the contract reform consultation. Steve, you've been through a similar process in Australia and you have the new dairy code of conduct. And as part of that, most Australian dairy processors have published their contracts online. What's the latest situation regarding farmer milk contracts down under?
So I think there was only one contract that didn't get put up straight away, and that party since rectified that. So we've got full disclosure of contracts. They sit on their websites. We have reasonably complex contracts. I think though the UK is pretty much up there in terms of, you know, the complexity of the terms and conditions and the way in which they're described. So we have many milk buyers. There's a lot more competition in the market in the last few years. While our industry hasn't grown, we've got more and more buyers, so it's really fragmented, and we don't have major cooperatives left after the demise of Murray Goulburn. So the farm gate environment is hotly competitive because we are still an export-focused country, even though most of the milk is staying on shore. We've got a lot more choice for farmers in the ways in which they can access the market. So there's many different contract styles. Even some processors are offering a number of different options to suit the production system or the end market that they're after. I still don't think there's as many options as farmers might have in the UK in terms of the way in which you either got to, you know, I remember back going way back, the supply contracts or the demand contracts, you know, you had things that were very much styled based on whether you were being pulled through by the demand side or not. We have a little bit of that here, but it's things are fairly tightly sprung. There's not a lot of difference between players. It really comes back to, you know, what farmers see in that system for themselves and what signals they want to respond to. We do have, it's taken a long while to happen, but we've got retailers buying direct off farm now. So Coles has gone out in the last couple of years, very much a Tesco follower, Coles, a lot of ex-execs sitting in Coles management roles. So they have gone after milk directly and using Saputo to process, lifting prices. So they are the best payer by some distance in some regions above the other fluid processors. So that's a fairly interesting dynamic, and they're sourcing in most regions. So look, for farmers, much more choice, much more complexity. Farmers try and work out what contracts mean. You need to have an Excel spreadsheet with all the details there because it is actually really complicated. Nothing is straightforward. Contracts get expressed in formulas. It's tables of numbers and the like. So it is a pretty complex story, but great choice.
John, Steve's given us a really comprehensive description of the situation in Australia today. What do you think British dairy farmers and the British dairy industry generally can learn from the situation down under?
The issue, I think, in the UK is that we've had some rogue operators, and those rogue operators have done a lot of bad press things for farmers. A lot of processors, frankly, have been behaving in the UK very responsibly, and probably we're going to end up having to try and do something about contracts to deal with the rogue elephants that we've got in the industry. And whether or not we need contracts changing is something to debate, because it's whether or not you need a tougher code of practice, and perhaps that's something that perhaps we all need to think about in the UK, a code of practice with some real teeth in it, where people shouldn't deal with certain processes if they don't behave ethically.
It's the environment around the farm gate, which is the interesting dynamic here because there's so much, I guess, competition. But contracts have, while they look quite different in some cases, it's different instruments. So it is quite a tangled web of, you know, different incentives and disincentives and things like that. There are standard inclusions which are mandatory, and the terms and conditions, you know, there's a number of things that must be there, a number of things that can't be there. So John used that term rogue operator. We got into this situation because there was a rogue operator or two that backtracked on pricing, and we had some other terms and conditions which were simply unfair to farmers. You know, people would sign a 2 or 3 year contract. The processor would say, no, we don't want you anymore. And there'd be things that were trailing, like trailing incentives that got left out or that they missed out on. And so that stuff was existed in a few cases. And so part of the issue was to prevent, you know, someone sets a price for a full year and they don't have a very good reason and get plenty of notice and all that sort of stuff. There was some really unfair terms that they had to stop, and just level the field and say, you all need to do this, this, and this, and this. So it is quite prescriptive, as to the things that must be there, must state what the minimum is. They must have certain, you know, state very clearly what all the terms, conditions are. Any hanging loyalties or any things that are conditional must be really clear, and you've got strong notice periods and things like that. So it has tidied up a lot of stuff that was going on, that's for sure.
Well,
so
good, that's a good question. Better off, though?
Still, look, I think better off will this mean that the prices cover their costs of operation or give them greater certainty? We're still swinging the world market, Chris. We're still, you know, year to year, even though more of our milk is staying on shore and it's, I guess, smoothed out a bit, the price signals are less extreme. You know, we have this spring pricing. I don't know if you're familiar with the prices tend to be higher in spring, sorry, lower in spring, and at either end of the system, particularly the second half, they are higher because it's harder to make milk. So that's still an inherent feature, but they've closed the gap on those a bit. So we've got more influence of that more stable domestic use, cheese use, and things like that, where the prices are. But year to year, it's still driven by the world market. But I guess there's greater certainty. There's, you know, if you're an enterprising farmer and you had a good business and you did your homework, you could actually, you know, you got more choice to find yourself an arrangement over multiple years. It's probably paying a better price than what you might have been aware of or accessing before.
Yeah, it's quite a complex issue, isn't it, Steve, to go through, because there's so many dynamics at play that they're virtually identical to the UK in terms of liquid.
So many parallels, aren't there?
Yeah, I mean, and retailers are probably do things to try and protect their brand by continuing to give a perception that they are looking after their suppliers. But it's very hard to maintain that when you are in an inflationary environment, a recessionary environment, you know, and where retailers can't help themselves but to keep on trying to want to take out costs.
What's increased the sensitivity between the retailer and the consumer has increased in this process, because they've actually worn a lot of brand damage in the way in which the farmers have been perceived to have been impacted. While the fact that milk prices didn't actually go down, that didn't matter. It's the way in which this is done, and it's the stigma and the way in which some aspects of the farm lobby campaigns over time got quite a bit of attention, and they cut through. And so we have seen various points when that sensitivity rose that the retailers saw sales drift across to brands again, away from their private label. So Australia's still quite a sensitive consumer market to those ends. And there's been times, and there was a time recently where the handling of the increase in this price, as the price has gone up, consumers said, no, still, you're not treating farmers well. So they've gone and supported brands. So there is, we're fickle. I think whether there's a parallel with the UK or not, I know the retailers in the UK quite well, but I think just the way, and, you know, the stability of that brand franchise in the UK versus Australia might be quite different, because here it's been stretched by that through that phase of the treatment of farmers.
The challenges that the retailers are going into, and the way I see it, is that they basically come to processor, whether it be of cheese or other dairy product, and they say, look, you know, you're supplying us, and they say, well, actually, you know what, we're going into tough times, we like you, we want you to keep on supplying us, we're going to give you twice the volume, but we don't want you to make any more money, and in exchange for that, we won't delist you. So that's basically how the deal is. So if you're the processor, you're in a very tough place if you're very reliant on that retail contract. And so that's how we've got a market developing currently in the UK. And that's why, you know, you'll start to see processors really start to think about, well, how do they handle this? And in reality, they're probably going to have to start to have strategies which will move their businesses away from being so reliant on those retailer relationships and diversify their portfolio of business. And ideally, long-term, develop some export opportunities, as Steve said, because at the end of the day, the price of milk will be determined by the world price. But when you're in a retail market like we are, where the retailers are almost demanding price cuts, they will almost usurp world market dynamics. And that's what we're heading to at present.
Right, I think, unfortunately, that's all we have time for. That's been a fascinating discussion. But thank you so much to Steve Spencer, John Allen, and Chris Walkland for coming on the show today.